Hello and welcome to Shades of Murder. I am your host, Alita Dagna. In this podcast, I will share with you tales of true crime from around the world and throughout history. In each episode, I delve deep into each case, discussing its many layers. Please be forewarned that this show contains graphic and at times very disturbing details of the case and may not be intended for all audiences. On March 17, 1979, at the Palmland Motel in Fort Myers, Florida, the body of 73-year-old Inez Kelly was discovered in her room. The old woman laid on the floor, beaten, bloodied, and bitten. Her head had been bashed in with a lamp. The perpetrator had tied a towel and pillowcase around her neck and strangled Inez Kelly to death. Local law enforcement began a hunt for whoever had slain this defenseless old woman. Bloody footprints led to Juanita Maxwell, a 22-year-old maid who worked at the Palmland Motel, whom the detectives found passed out during her shift. When the police spoke to her about the murder, they noticed she had splatters of blood on her shoes and a scratch that appeared indicative of a defensive wound. Juanita explained that she had no intention of harming Ms. Inez and that it should have been her mother lying there dead instead. Juanita Maxwell swore that she had no memory of killing Inez Kelly, but all evidence pointed to the contrary. She was held at the Florida State Hospital under psychiatric supervision for almost 2 years while she awaited trial for first-degree murder. Little did the police or the courts understand at the time that it was not Juanita who had brutally murdered the older tenant, Inez Kelly. No, it was Wanda Weston, the other personality who shared her brain. It was discovered by psychiatrists that Juanita Maxwell had dissociative identity disorder. Let us step back a moment and discuss what dissociative identity disorder, or DID, is. According to the DSM, it is characterized by the presence of two or more personalities or distinct identities within one person. At least one of these identities must take over the actions of the primary person or host body, who has no recollection and is unable to remember any connection to the behavior of the other identity. This excludes any explanation that could be made by the effects of drugs or alcohol that may induce a blackout or some other medical condition like epilepsy. Dissociative identity disorder is a mental disorder where the person, also known as the host body, holds more than one personality within their brain. These different personalities tend to be fragments of the primary host's personality. With the intention of coping with severe trauma, the brain splits itself into multiple pieces. The identities behave, think, and remember in different ways from one another. Each personality has a different voice and often calls themselves by a different name. These different and distinct identities can be any age, race, gender, ethnicity, and background. Each different identity has unique interests, personas, and attitudes. They may wear clothes and engage in activities that the other identities don't. Some personalities may be aware of the others, but sometimes none of them are. When the body is taken over by one of the other personalities, the host body will commonly suffer from blackouts during this time, when the other identity is in control. The very first time dissociative identity disorder was recorded was in 1815. A patient named Mary Reynolds was observed as having sleeping up to 18 hours a day. And then all of a sudden, she would awaken, and there were major differences or even blanks in her memories. She carried herself differently, and she even wrote differently. The first case that raised society's awareness, or at least attention, to the disorder was that of a woman named Chris Sizemore in 1954. She was observed as having two very distinct identities, whom her psychiatrist named Eve White and Eve Black. Eve White was deemed the dominant identity, and Eve Black's presence was initially quite rare. Eve White had no recollection of what Eve Black did or said while she was under control. But on the contrary, Eve Black knew every piece of Eve White's memories and life experiences. Between 1922 and 1972, there were only 50 recorded diagnoses of what was then known to be multiple personality disorder. Then in 1973, the true story of Sybil, a young woman with multiple personalities, was released. This book made a huge impact on the psychiatric community and brought awareness of the mental disorder to both the public and the medical world. Sybil was a massive media sensation at this time. The book sold millions of copies, spawned a made-for-television miniseries, and made the author, the psychoanalyst who had been Sybil's doctor, and the real woman behind the book very wealthy and famous. Now, allegedly, years later, Sybil confessed to faking the disorder, and some believe that she was severely depressed and desperate for attention. However, these accounts are based on one woman's expose, which others' accounts dispute this. So the truth of the woman behind Sybil, who was named Shirley Mason, may forever remain a mystery. Nevertheless, the story of Sybil garnered so much attention and interest that it forever changed the way multiple personality disorder, or now known as DID, was handled by psychiatrists and the criminal law. It was only after the media sensation that was Sybil that the DSM-5, that is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, would include multiple personalities within its listed disorders in 1980. Doctors who believe it is a legitimate mental disorder think that it is highly underdiagnosed, with as high as 20% of inpatient and outpatient psychiatric clients having the mental disorder. It is considered to be especially prevalent among survivors of historical sexual trauma. One study conducted on people with DID in the US, Canada, and Europe found that approximately 90% of those diagnosed with a mental disorder have been victims of severe childhood abuse and neglect. And for the vast majority, the trauma they experienced was repetitive and so overwhelming that their brains fragmented into more than one. At her court hearing in 1981, mental health experts, much to the shock and skepticism of those at court, summoned Wanda Weston to come forward at Juanita Maxwell's trial. Similar to how a psychic or medium is depicted in films and shows that conjure up another spirit, Juanita Maxwell shut her eyes and bowed her head. Within 10 seconds, someone else looked through her eyes and began to laugh. She introduced herself as Wanda Weston, a childhood friend of the defendants. The entire courthouse was taken back as Juanita's soft-spoken and calm demeanor was replaced by this boisterous and aggressive woman. Wanda explained how it was a simple argument that day between Juanita and the older woman that suddenly erupted into extreme violence. Juanita Maxwell had lent her pen earlier in the day to a tenant residing at the Palmland Motel, who was later identified as 73-year-old Inez Kelly. During two different times that same day, Juanita asked if she could have her pen back. Both times, the older woman slammed the door in her face. Wanda Weston confessed to the court how she murdered Miss Kelly and laughed about how she had killed that defenseless old woman. As to why she murdered her? Because she didn't like the way she talked to Juanita. Wanda Weston explained to the court that even though Juanita was there with her physically at the time of the murder, she was completely unaware of what was happening. She informed the police that Inez Kelly had really angered her, and she was a reminder of the cruelty and verbal abuse she had suffered by her mother. According to Juanita, her mother was an abusive alcoholic who constantly was fighting with her stepfather. He left them when Juanita was only 8 years old. Her mother turned to prostitution and would throw her young daughter out of the house every night while her mother took care of her clients. Little Juanita was left alone on the streets every night, wandering around. A small child who was made vulnerable to all kinds of trouble and danger. In the eighth grade, Juanita dropped out of school. She was forced by her own mother to sell her body to men. At only 12 years old, her mother tried to kill her by strangling her with a belt. The little girl had had enough, and that same night, Juanita snuck into her mother's bedroom with a rope. However, before she managed to slip the rope around her mother's neck, Juanita blacked out. When she awoke, she was lying underneath the house, and next to her laid 6 dead kittens. It would be decades later before she understood what had happened that night. Wanda Weston had appeared when she wanted to murder her own mother. In order for Juanita to be stopped, she intervened and redirected her rage towards the innocent kittens instead, snapping each of their necks. The abuse and violence Juanita was forced to suffer was not limited to being forced into sex work by her own mother. Juanita was also raped by her own cousin. One day he grabbed her and shoved her head into a bucket of water, holding it there forcibly, as the young girl choked and gagged on the water until she finally had no other choice but to give in and let him assault her. Juanita attempted to escape the hell that was her daily existence with her mother by running away. Unfortunately, she was found and sent to a state mental hospital in Arcadia. There, the doctors judged her to be yet another troubled adolescent, filled her up with drugs, and sent her back home to the monster who called herself her mother. As a young woman, Juanita had 3 daughters and was married to a very abusive adulterer. Her mother was still actively in her life, and they constantly fought and battled with one another. The day before Inez Kelly was viciously slain in her motel room, Juanita had a terrible fight with her mother, who had attempted to stab her with a pair of scissors. Based on the evidence presented by the psychiatrist and by Juanita's altar, the judge declared her not guilty by reason of insanity and returned her back to the Florida State Hospital in Chattahoochee, Florida. Although she did receive some psychotherapy, what Juanita was mainly provided with was a very high dosage of Haldol every day for 5 years. This drug does absolutely nothing to treat dissociative identity disorder. It is an antipsychotic medication designed to treat schizophrenia, specifically to help manage delusions and hallucinations. However, multiple personalities cannot be successfully treated this way because the disorder does not cause delusions or hallucinations, at least not the high majority of the time. Dissociative identity disorder can be understood as a split, a fracturing of the brain that creates different personalities or identities to help the host identity cope with the trauma. Research has shown that only with intense psychotherapy can the host identity ever come to terms with the trauma they have suffered. And only then is it even possible for the multiple identities to merge back into one. Sometimes medications are also prescribed to help with depression and anxiety that may accompany the ID, but nothing can really help a patient except for talk therapy or psychotherapy. As already mentioned, instead of being sent to prison for committing murder, Juanita was ordered to be cared for at a mental health institution. Within 5 years, the doctors declared her as being cured of her mental disorder, and they released her back into society. Juanita was not the only one, though, who was freed. Wanda Weston was also now free, and not long after, she got herself, and by extension Juanita, entangled in the criminal justice system again. Nothing good or healing was waiting for Juanita Maxwell when she returned home from the state hospital. Her being welcomed home included her husband beating her so severely that she ended back in the hospital. Something did change for Juanita, though, during her stay away, because she was strong enough now to leave her abusive husband behind. She moved away to St. Petersburg and met a new man. While Juanita was detained at the state hospital, her children had all been placed with one of her aunts, who lived in Ohio, and she had not had any contact with her children while she was away. Then everything changed when Juanita discovered that she had a heart condition. While Juanita slept, Wanda came up with a way for her to visit her children one last time, which of course would require money, little of which Juanita had. Wanda Weston took over and plotted a few robberies. She succeeded at robbing two banks, but then she and her host body Juanita were arrested. Once Juanita was examined by psychiatrists again, this time she revealed to them that it was not only her and Wanda that were housed inside the same brain, but there were five additional personalities. Yes, that is correct. Juanita Maxwell had seven separate and unique identities. Once she served her time at the state hospital, Juanita returned to psychotherapy, and the state paid for her to be trained as a certified nursing assistant. I find it very interesting and ironic that they would train a mental health patient to work in the medical field. Apparently, though, Juanita loved working in nursing, and she felt as if she had found her calling. It was later noted that several employees at the hospital Juanita worked at had observed her different personalities. It was during this time when she finally learned how fragmented her identity really was. A mental health care counselor named Rita Bruno felt deep sympathy for Juanita, and she began to teach her how to be aware of what was happening when one of her other personalities took control. This healthcare worker would record conversations with Juanita's alternate personalities and then have Juanita listen to them. Although she resisted strongly at first and didn't want to know anything about her other identities, Juanita eventually listened to all of the sessions. She learned how different they were from one another, including their styles, their personas, their beliefs, and many of them practiced different religions. Linda was the practical identity who didn't need to wear eyeglasses when all the other identities did. Jennifer was her smart and sexy alternate personality who had earned Juanita her equivalent of a high school GED. She also sometimes left behind wigs and body-hugging red dresses inside Juanita's closet. Trisha was revered as the tough one who had first surfaced when Juanita was 9 years old, so she could handle working in the fields. There was Anne, whom Juanita created while struggling during labor with her first child. And Anna, a little girl whose primary purpose was so that Juanita could openly show her emotions and cry. While she was away at the state hospital, she had created an eighth identity named Susan, who helped her to deal with all of the doctors there. Therapy would also reveal that Wanda Weston had first surfaced when Juanita was only 5 years old, so that she could be protected from the extreme abuse she suffered. And the others would surface during critical times in her life. Dissociative identity disorder is considered by many health experts to be a technique for survival. Juanita herself believes that the only thing that prevented her from being psychotic or suicidal was the creation of her other identities. Therapy revealed that Wanda and all of the other identities were aware of what was going on, and they could see and hear Juanita. But when one of the other identities took control, Juanita was completely unaware of it happening. She described it as this, and I quote, "Imagine you're in a dark room with no windows or doors. You know people are outside because you can hear the noise. That's what it's like." Even though the judge disagreed that Juanita should be held accountable due to her mental health condition, Juanita acknowledged that she is Wanda, she is Linda, she is all of them, and they all committed the crime. As she put it, "We are us, I am them. Those different persons split off from me." She did not want to plead insane again and be returned to the state hospital. So a psychologist within the court system looked for the best place for her to receive treatment. In 1991, Circuit Judge Grable Studemeyer permitted Juanita to plead no contest to the bank robberies. This type of plea is when a defendant chooses not to plead guilty, but also accepts the charges against them, and whatever punishment the court decides to give them, they accept. In Juanita's case, the judge sentenced her to 3 years in jail, which was considered time served, and she was placed on probation for life. In many respects, Juanita Maxwell had become the new Sybil, and every piece of sensationalized media wanted to cover her and her bizarre story. All at once, the biggest names in interview and talk shows like Oprah, Geraldo, Montel, and 60 Minutes at the time all wanted to cash in on this too crazy, not to be true case. Then Juanita suddenly lost her job and her nursing certification since the government who had trained her and certified her for this line of work now claimed that she was not permitted to work within the field of nursing due to her criminal record. Juanita felt lost all over again, but at least she knew who she was, what she had endured and survived, and could take steps to finally heal. This case and other similar cases where the defendant has claimed that their other personality committed the crime, or that their mental illness is what is to blame, is wrought with controversy and skepticism, especially the leniency of sentencing it can sometimes be accompanied with. The core concept of criminal law lies in the actus reus and the mens rea, that is, the intention and the act itself. Dissociative identity disorder lies within the parameters of the insanity defense. The insanity defense can only be employed when it can be shown that the defendant is not capable of forming mens rea to commit the crime, or that they were not in control over the actions at the time of the offense due to their mental disorder. Further, it can also be established that the defendant was unaware of the consequences of the crime they committed. Individuals with dissociative identity disorder have been identified as having more than one personality. Specifically, personalities that are so distinct from one another that they can be perceived as being different people. If one person is totally unaware of the actions being committed by another, in this case the other personality, it stands to reason that under the definition of mens rea, they cannot be held liable if they did not form the intent. If it can be proven that a defendant has dissociative identity disorder, then it is suggested that the defendant had no control over their actions. And even more critical to criminal law, the intentions of the other personalities. This effectively eliminates the element of mens rea from the crime. Similar to the difficulty in proving criminal culpability in sleepwalkers is, as I covered last year in Canada's Sleepwalking Killer, episode 16. How can a criminal court hold a person accountable for the actions of another personality, one whom they are not aware of, are not conscious of during the time of the other identity's actions, and which they have zero control over? There are lingering doubts around dissociative identity disorder and those who claim to suffer from it, with some psychiatrists and many in the courts believing that many individuals attempt to fake DID to receive a not guilty by reason of insanity ruling. The main issue lies in the legitimacy of the mental disorder and whether the diagnosis is true. Such a complex and multi-layered mental disorder appears to be incredibly difficult to fake. But like other mental disorders, it is not impossible, and courts have judged that some defendants are fraudulent in their attempts at the insanity defense. The second major concern for a defendant diagnosed with DID is their competence to stand trial. This is a common concern for anyone with a mental disorder who may not understand the legal process which they face, and they may be incapable of comprehending the charges held against them. If another personality surfaces during a criminal trial and the host body has no awareness and no memory of what occurred during that time, then it is difficult to determine whether the defendant understands or knows what is happening in the legal process. How can an individual be considered competent to stand trial if they may not even be fully conscious of what is going on during court? The primary goal in a court of law, then, is to determine the diagnosis of dissociative identity disorder by gauging the clinical and neuropsychological characteristics associated with a mental disorder. The reliability of measures for the assessment of the disorder are in question by some, since there are such few mechanisms that are used to gauge the patient's dissociative identity disorder. However, since almost all of the assessment is based on psychotherapy interviews, it is believed that faking a legitimate condition would be incredibly difficult to do. Those who have been proven to have faked the disorder tend to claim the manifestation of stereotypical identities, and they focus on avoiding knowing what triggered the disorder at all. Studies have suggested that in order for an individual to fake the disorder, they would need to maintain the voice, memory, persona, and specific distinctions between each of the identities they are attempting to manifest. This would be extremely challenging to do. Not impossible, but the high majority of individuals would not be able to pull off such a psychological hoax. In 1999, results from a survey conducted on board-certified psychiatrists in the United States discovered that as few as 21% believed that there was scientific evidence of the validity of dissociative identity disorder. This clinical and legal skepticism has changed and progressed in the last few decades, in big part to the APA updating the diagnostic criteria for DID. Since 2013, the criteria now includes, and I quote, the symptoms of disruption of identity may be reported as well as observed, and that gaps in the recall of events may occur for every day and not just traumatic events. A larger body of research on the mental disorder has also helped to legitimize DID. There is some confusion on the overlapping or similar diagnosis between dissociative identity disorder and schizophrenia, both of which patients have been inaccurately diagnosed. DID and schizophrenia can share some similarities in symptoms, but most of the diagnostic criteria are vastly different. For example, for individuals diagnosed as being schizophrenic, they have poor reality testing, which in layman's terms mean that they have difficulty distinguishing between self and non-self, and between reality and fantasy. They also tend to have inappropriate affect, which is when someone's emotional reactions or responses are incompatible with their intentions or conflict with the situation. An example of this would be if someone laughed when someone told them their friend just died. Patients diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder have clearly distinguished lines between reality and fantasy and tend to behave in emotionally appropriate ways. Very little research has been done on the neuroanatomical differences in someone with DID, but the data has shown to have some significant differences. The cortical and subcortical volumes of the parts of the brain that control perception and personal awareness, and the frontal parts which execute movement and fear learning, were found to be noticeably smaller in patients with DID. It was also observed that they had larger white matter tracts, whose function is information communication. Similar to research conducted on schizophrenia and other major mental disorders, a person suffering from DID is not necessarily a threat to society, and most patients are more likely to be harmed by others or cause harm to themselves. However, some studies have shown that almost half of all patients diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder exhibited violence. These violent tendencies greatly increase the probability of an individual with DID committing a crime, in particular a violent one. Any attempt to prevent a crime from being committed is next to impossible due to the fragmentation of the person's mind. So the question remains, what is the fair and just punishment for someone who unknowingly, at least on a conscious level, commits murder? Psychologically, it may be the mental disorder which triggered or caused the crime, but does that mean the person is not at all criminally responsible? This type of question will be asked many times over in this podcast because there are so many cases in which justice is not clearly outlined or defined for the perpetrator in the crime. I don't know if there is a clear answer to this question, and like most crimes and offenders, they should be handled on a case-by-case basis. I don't think that traditional incarceration for someone diagnosed with DID or really any severe mental illness is the answer. That would only aggravate the disorder and its symptoms. Something has to be done, though, to ensure that they don't murder another innocent person, but how is that truly preventable, even in the most secure of institutions? I leave you with some questions to ponder. Should an individual be free to live their life as if their hands were not the ones who took another life? As a society, can we justify punishing a mentally ill person who had no control or memory of the event when they did not form the criminal intent? Can our society handle the fallout and potential repercussions of not keeping a dangerous perpetrator in a secure facility? What do you think? Do you believe that Juanita Maxwell should have been freed after receiving drugs and a little psychotherapy after 5 years? Do you think it was wise to have the judge after she had re-offended and robbed 2 banks? Let her go and only gave her life probation? I can't imagine if I were the one to have committed the crime, in particular a violent crime, such as murder. Even though I had no intention or conscious part of my own doing, would I feel as if my actions should be left unpunished? I would be terrified that if I wasn't on the perfect balance of medication and psychotherapy, that my other identities could resurface and select murder as the best option to my problems. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show and want to support it, please follow and subscribe. Consider a 5-star rating and share so it reaches more fellow kindred spirits and we can all embrace the love, the darkness together. Until next time, stay safe and watch out for shades of murder happening in the streets, next door, and especially inside your own home. Shades of Murder was created, researched, written, and edited by Alita Dogma. Music courtesy of Pixabay by Ashat Danilian.